This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and we are on the phone with Rochester, New York, interviewing Tom Ward at his BOA publishing offices. And here's Tom to say hello with a poem all the way from New York.
The little poem is called Solidarity, from my recent collection, The Matter of the Casket. Solidarity. "Why won't you let me have you?" said the man to his bottle of vodka. "Because you only have me and the others when you're frustrated or sad," said the bottle. "That's what liquor is for," said the man, who lived by himself in a small, clean house. "No, that's what you think we are for," said the bottle. "The space you leave in the bottle you pour fills up with your irritability and grief. We no longer want this. Just ask the scotch." "But that is your function. You exist to serve people," said the man, as he furiously twisted the tops of half-empty bottles of tequila and gin, but the tops would not budge. "The vote was unanimous," said the bottle of vodka. "We believe in solidarity. If you won't open, I'll take a hammer and..." The man was shouting now. Yes, your rage. "We refuse that too," said the bottle. "Go ahead, hammer away and create broken glass. We'll swim over your counters and floors, and still, you'll have no liquor." "Damn you. Damn all of you," the man shouted, frantically searching his tidy kitchen for something heavy and hard.
Tom Ward, the inimitable voice, and that is from his new book, The Matter of the Casket. Custom Words came out in 2007 and was on my list as one of the best books of the year. Tom is the editor of BOA Editions Limited, and that's an independent publishing house of poetry and poetry and translation and fiction, and he'll talk about that later after he talks about his own work. Tom, are you working on a new book?
Yes, I am. Basically, a configuration of what I call loose sonnets, 14-line sonnets that aren't necessarily metrical or end-rhymed, but they hide their rhymes internally and externally, and then jam most of their lines. And so that's the majority of the manuscript. There are some of the free verse lyrics and narratives in it as well.
Well, that sounds scary to people who don't know poetry, but let's hear one, because you are funny, you're sweet, you're ironic, you're wry, and they'll get it. So read us one.
Okay, a loose sonnet. I will read you this little fiction called Actually, However. Actually, however, it's my little, if there were two characters in this, well, I like to think that Pacino or De Niro could have starred as the bad guy in this little fiction. Actually, however, he fell and fell hard, like his heart was a mob informant and she, the East River. Actually, he was a mob informant, the only way to advance his stalled career on the squad. She, however, was not the East River, but the black leather, blue-eyed mistress of Butch the Barracuda. Few saltwater fish in the East River. However, there were plenty of decomposing informants. Even he knew that. Knew her mouth was moist as a June strawberry. Carton shipped from the docks, along with the guns and the crack. Actually, he had never kissed her, though he knew how succulent she would taste, especially at night along the shore of the East River. However, at the card table in the back of the warehouse, he called Butch by his Christian name, instantly blowing his cover, the cold bullet finding his brain, and he now finding himself sinking in the East River, which he always knew had never actually been her.
Tom Ward, and it's T-H-O-M Ward, if you want to check him out and Google him. Tom, are you aware that you write poetry like no one else?
I'm not so sure about that, but
you're quite
I'm not
different.
So sure I've ever had an original idea in my life. I may have concocted or invented a few new hows, how the language strings together in syllable and silence. I don't know.
Somebody would say to you, Tom, tell us in one sentence what you think your poems are about. Describe your poems in one sentence.
Well, at this point, you know, in someone's, any poet's aesthetic sensibilities tend to change, we hope grow and alter, and you don't, they're not calcified aesthetics. I like to think that my poems balance levity and gravitas, that they can think and sing and sing and think, and they advance some kind of dramatic urgency, some kind of something at stake, something that's at risk, or something awry, and the language has got to play that through and out, and maybe there's an epiphany at the end, or maybe it's not, like in the last poem, things just sort of spin out of control for our unnamed mob informant protagonist, and that's how it ends. It doesn't end with a bang or a whimper. It just ends sort of open-ended. So that's where I am in my writing right now. That obviously could switch 5 or 10 years from now as well.
Other poetry collections of Tom are Tumble Kid, which was University of South Carolina, A Small Boat with Oars of Different Size, that was Carnegie Mellon, and Various Orbits, that was Carnegie Mellon as well. As we said, the latest one is The Matter of the Casket, and it will make you really scared and happy at the same time. It's sort of a Billy Collins thing where tragedy and comedy dance on the head of a pin. Let's hear another poem, Tom Ward.
Okay. So let's see. Spooky. By the way, my 13-year-old son calls this Daddy's Spooky Little Book. Hmm. I rather like that.
He'll be a good critic.
Yeah. Well, speaking of son, well, many of these poems, of course, they lead toward fictions, and it's made-up stuff, and I've got a lot of animals in here because I'm fond of animals, from ducks to alligators to hippos to lots of dogs and cats. And I'm going to read one that is a little more meditative and may draw from my studies or my intense relationship. But growing up being a Presbyterian, I guess I'd now call myself a wayward pagan. But at this point, growing up, I was very involved with the Presbyterian Church and religious studies, and also in acting out. I was in Jesus Christ Superstar and Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat and all those rock operas that use the Old and New Testament as their touchstone. So thinking about all that and not thinking about it, and the fact I also love geology, here's a little poem called Of Rocks. Of Rocks. When do rocks get to retire? Geologists report wind and water action over millions of years reduces boulders to pebbles, and it's hard to disagree with that. But isn't there a point when rocks don't have to punctuate mountains, reinforce lakes, contribute to the geological GNP? As with octogenarians, do they ever get to eat dessert first, take spontaneous naps? The Bible, which often illuminates, or at least parables, is of little help. Simon Peter, whom our Lord named Rock, didn't get to enjoy his retirement. No shuffleboard or golf for him. In this common era, we have unions. Still, is there ever a day when an outcrop gets a coffee break? I empathize with rocks, being mortals like us, aging painfully, shingles and arthritis, yet without the safety net of Social Security. Perhaps in the Sea of Galilee, it wasn't fish Simon and his pals were trying to snare, but rocks, smooth to the touch, void of tongues, modest and reliable. Rocks, here before and hereafter, quietly doing their innocuous rock things, never yearning for prophets or messiahs.
Is that from The Matter of the Casket?
That'd be from The Matter of the Casket. Mm-hmm.
Even rocks have souls, you know, Tom. Do you believe that? I hope you played Jesus Christ. I hope you had the lead. Did you?
No, I played Judas. That's the best role.
That is the best role. What emotional impulse or pressure is inside of you that makes you write, that allows you to write?
That's a very fine question. You know, because people talk about being inspired. I'm seldom inspired, and I seldom have a original thought. But if I hear something that's an unusual use of language, and often my children, who are now older, my adopted kids, and I have my 12-year-old who I'm genetically responsible for, but all three of them have wonderful uses of languages, as all kids and young people do. And in a number of poems, especially in Tumble Kid and Small Boat, I stole some of these ideas and then would write them out. For instance, one night I heard my son 21, and back then he was about 9. As he was cleaning his room, asked his mother, "Hey, Mom, where you put my ascension cord?" as playing the tongue tripper off the extension cord, I thought, that's a fascinating, ascension cord. And it turns out, of course, he was a C-section cesarean baby. And so, you know, I start that poem with a bleed-in title, "While We Rest, He Cleans His Room, Sifts Through Books, Games, Puzzles, Ninja Turtles, Colored Markers, Burbly, Silly Makeup Songs. Hey, Mom, where'd you put my ascension cord?" "I don't know, sweetie," she replies, most of her body crumpled into sleep, and off it goes. So that's all I do, this ascension cord. So I'm very good, I think, at taking an elocution or a strange riff of language and spinning it out and trying to find what I like to call a variety of philosophical and psychological urgencies that are surprising. It's very important, I think, without forcing it, that that you surprise the reader in a variety of emotional and intellectual ways in a poem, so it keeps the reader engaged and looking forward to the next line, the next move.
I think you do it, Tom. That poem that you just recited, I think you didn't read that, because I know that you commit poems, vast memory poems, and I've heard you go off for an hour reciting our venerable poets from the past. So were you reading that one just now or not?
No, I was reciting that bit.
How is it that you can do that without fear?
I don't think it's that difficult. You know, for years, we know from troubadour traditions, and the latest scholarship is that the Odyssey was not, Homer was not one person, but a series of people, including women, who actually memorized a variety of chapters to keep that poem in the consciousness of Western civilization. Of course, from Dylan Thomas and just a variety of other fine, excellent poets, far superior to myself. Eliot also loved to recite. I actually find startling that the poets I know, again, very accomplished poets, don't memorize poems or recite them as much as I would think or hope or like to at a reading. My take on it is, especially when I've memorized a number of Yeats and Dickinson poems, because the way they use language is so powerful and so enigmatic that if I memorize a poem, I literally metabolize it and I can get inside and understand things about the poem, have my own sort of interpretations have more depth and more clarity than if I just was reading the poem with my eyes and eyes and eyes again. We'll call that the education part of it. The other part I love about reciting poems is, you know, you can pop them off, during a bar or a family occasion or any time that the writers gather, and it's always fun to be able to quip that way. But, you know, most importantly, you're never bored, especially it keeps you out of trouble in traffic jams and not being overzealous. I often recite poems driving, especially in bad weather. And when things get slow, instead of, you know, hitting your horn and getting sort of worked up into a type A personality, you know, you can just look at the truck driver next to you, and he can't see you, but you're mouthing, "The night Skylab was falling. I can stand in the doorway or hug myself in the cold or rush out into the ache of evening. I am near the one who waits no longer. She gave up seeking the safety of things, and now the earth is at home in her. No need to picture luck taking aim or why God lifts away when Isaiah dies. So what use is fear or planning ahead?" That's a wonderful poem by Boa poet Tony Piccioni.
That ought to scare the truck driver to death.
Oh, it scares the bejesus out of his mouth and the things, you know, who knows what I'm not trying to do.
Read or recite us one of yours now. This is Tom Ward you're going to hear. Tell us the book it's coming from or the new book.
Matter of the casket. This is a fun poem. "Porcelain dolls have always given me the willies. My daughter, that's a good one. My sister had a bunch of these dolls that were on bay windows growing up, and I thought, as I just stared out inexorably at us wee children, I thought, what if we put them in a dramatic situation with, let's say, a piggy bank and see what the heck happens there? So this poem is simply called Dolls. Prose poem. Three porcelain dolls have surrounded the piggy bank. This is a stick-up, they shout in unison. Come out with your hooves held high. But I am the bank, the pig says, without moving an inch. How can I come out of myself? Puzzled, the dolls stare at each other. Such responses were not part of the curriculum at the vocational school for ceramic persons. Listen, you little oinker. That tricky language stuff isn't going to work, says the ringleader, the doll with brunette curls, the largest eyes. I'm merely stating the obvious, the pig replies. I can no more come out of myself than you ladies can stop your perpetual staring. What she's telling you, says the red-haired doll, is that you need to cooperate. It's that simple. Let me reiterate. The bank and myself, myself and the bank, transcend the traditional categories of subject and object. Hence, you must relieve yourselves of the concept of coming out. Yes, and you, little oinker, must relieve yourself of some blood, says the ringleader. Which will happen, says the blonde, when this gun relieves itself of some bullets.
Tom Ward, we're talking to him from Rochester, New York, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and I'm Grace Cavalieri. Tom, if someone were to call you an associate of the metaphysical poets, what would that mean to you?
I will say in one little essay that it's probably an idea that I've massaged in my own mind and with my own language that I have always challenged myself and the poets I edit at BOA and the adult poets I work with one-on-one here and tutor, and they're wonderful poets that teach me as much as I teach them, that, you know, you really are looking for aesthetic concerns, language concerns. You want to supercharge your language and poetry, make it a little more intense than regular communication or speech for the most part. But to have those aesthetic experiences, try to locate, and I'm not going to try to get too headsy here, but to locate real philosophical, psychological, and also metaphysical urgencies, you know, and which has to get into other realms of ontology. How is it like to be? What it is to be a human being? And, of course, epistemology. How is it to like to know or not to know, or what can we know, or how does our perception blind our knowing? And is knowing involved in time and space, or is our consciousness dictate time and space? And a lot of these ideas that wonderful philosophers have debated for years. The object, of course, is, as I would say in these kind of poems, which are, you know, greatly practiced by poets such as Emily Dickinson and Wall Stevens and Yeats, is to get enough poetry in there so that you're not writing some kind of philosophical tract. You're leading with your imagination. Very important to lead with your imagination, create new worlds, create new characters, and yet the poem still has some heft underneath. You're not just saying, as the poet Stephen Dunn says in one of his wonderful essays, you're not just conveying the passable truths, but you're looking to provide in the versions of the language and the fictions that you create, possibly new landscapes that the reader can give themselves over to willingly and see the world in a different way and wake themselves up, if only momentarily, to new perceptions and new understandings of what it is to be this angel beast thing we are, this thing we call ourselves human.
That's Tom Ward talking. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and he's the author of several books of poetry. We're talking to him by phone from his office at BOA Editions, and we're going to hear, Tom, another poem from one of your books.
Trying to find something metaphysical.
Well, my idea of what metaphysical is a finer point where the poets that we know to be metaphysical poets had one idea of the word love, but there was really a sharp fang underneath that word love. And I believe you do that. You turn words around so that they have almost an opposite meaning sometime to make your point. So any of your poems would qualify as metaphysical. Just open the book and see what falls out.
You're so generous. I appreciate that. Here's one that I hope has... I have five object poems in here. Belt, match, pill, fire hydrant, and floor. This one, is near and dear to me because it's playful, I believe, but then it really... about the metaphysical poets, and I'm certainly not going to compare myself to Donne and others, but let's see how it goes. Here, it's a short one. It's, again, a meditative poem with no voices in it, just an omniscient narrator. Consequence. Belt has grown tired of the geography of flesh. It would welcome the chance to reach around a tiny portion of sky and keep it close. Calf leather and brass, its five holes are the wells where the five books of Moses were first protected. Nobody remembers this, or that belt was cut from the belly of the sun, adores marching bands. As with most things which support, belt has been disregarded, strung up in dark corners, tossed over chairs, left in the back seats of cars. A few sessions of psychiatric counseling might help, but no one's thought to offer. Instead, it's wait till your father comes home, or next time it's going to be more than my hand. Oh, how belt laments such work.
Oh, that is wonderful. I also love the poem Pill from that same section. They're so great.
Pill is here. Wellness, and it's called, the poem is actually called On Wellness, but here we go to sort of personify Pill. Sensing a bout of unwellness, Pill took a woman. Heals first, of course, with a glass of water, as long as the woman's legs. Sometimes for unwellness, Pill took two or three middle-aged men, brawny forearms and delts, but the disconcerting side effects, namely an icy petulance, made Pill feel rather un-Pill. The time-release efficacy of adolescence was always a boon, but they came fortified with hormones. Better to suffer unwellness than a rash of zits. Young children, far too syrupy, and God didn't yet come in a bottle. So Pill took a woman to ward off her unwellness, happy with her shoes, unhappy with her hair, between menstruation and menopause, sealed for your protection, extra strength.
Oh, Tom, you'll go down in history for that.
I don't know. I'm not sure about that.
What can the reader find out about his or her life from reading your poems?
Well, you got the big questions here. I would like to think that in the meditations that I create from memory, and then also add a dollop and dash of this of fictionings. As I said, I'm a big fan of Alice in Wonderland, and I think in our best poems we drop down the rabbit hole of our imagination, see what new Tweedledees and Tweedledums and Mad Hatters and March Hares and Cheshire Cats we may find. I would hope that in that sort of wandering logos journey of my imagination and memory coming together, that people would see in themselves what they know, but maybe have forgotten or misremembered, namely that we are wonderful, brilliant, beautiful, terrifying, ambiguous, ambivalent, fallen, confused creatures making our way best on this planet. The only creatures that biologists tell us, of course, that know that our own demise is imminent. We like to think, you know, we know that there's other mammals that communicate directly, although they never communicate in metaphors. Chimpanzees and dolphins don't do that. We do, and they also aren't aware that they are going to expire and die. And so with that balance of Eros and Thanatos, the death presence, somewhere in that friction, I hope to make the language exist and to, as I mentioned before, think and sing and find a little bit of humor, and also find some serious governing intents, some unexpected inevitabilities that make the reader go, aha, I remember that. Yes, I know this in my own terms, but this poem has helped illuminate it for me, and I'm thankful for that.
Well, I think that's where Tom Ward exists, between Eros and Thanatos, and he is also available because he gives lectures on literary publishing and poetry to audiences around the country, and also recites poems, and I think probably does a little karaoke if we're not careful. And this is Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and we will be right back. We are back. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and we're interviewing Tom Ward, T-H-O-M Ward. He's in Rochester, New York, and he's just shoveled out handfuls, armfuls, truckfuls of snow. But he got to us anyway, so thank you. And let's remind everyone who you are with a poem by Tom Ward.
Here's the first poem from the collection, The Man of the Caskets. And envisions a situation in which, speaking of Eros and Thanatos, a man has died, and now he is in some sort of aura or place that he's not sure. It's simply called Gates. Gates. "So is this the gate?" said the man to what he assumed to be an angel who stood before a barrier not known to Earth. It resembled a thick yet translucent column of wax. "There are many gates," said the angel. "I mean the gate, the one I worked to achieve in my life, the one that proves I did more help than hurt." "There are many gates," said the angel. "How easily an adoring crowd becomes a vindictive mob, how quickly a beam of light twists into shadow." "I don't understand," said the man. "Your task is to discover what shape you are," said the angel. "Then you will know where to find and how to pass through the gates." "But I'm already dead," cried the man. "I have no shape." "Death has a host of shapes to be discovered," said the angel. "Others have." "This is all so confusing," said the man. "What about Pearly and that eye of the needle and camel thing? We were told those are the clues." "Do not panic. Time is no longer an issue," said the angel. "And remember, there are many gates."
Oh, while we have you in our arms, go right to another poem. That would be tragic, considering your first poem.
Puts everything in the right perspective. A few more lost brain cells.
And now,
there's a little poem called Blobs. I will admit this poem has more of a memory trigger because my 13-year-old son, back when he was 8 or 9, would draw these little things called Blobs, and they were crazy little characters. And I loved seeing him draw my 2 adopted kids, and he have wonderful acumen for drawing. In one of my essays, I write that I am a thrice failed musician, which is true, and that I once almost blew up a pinch pot in a kiln in high school, the only high school almost to do that. So it shows you how good I am with working with the clay matter, and that you can see my drawings in the American Museum of Stick People and Other Aesthetic Disasters. That's right next to the Air and Space Museum in Washington. If you haven't checked that out yet, Grace, it exists.
Are you kidding?
In my mind.
Oh, in your mind.
My mind. That museum, but. Saying all that, this is called Blobs. Day and night, his son drew blobs, always in pencil. Blobs had giant heads and giant eyes joined together, tiny crosses for arms and legs, and seemed to levitate on the page. His father watched and grew curious. Blobs didn't have to work or think, talk or worry, being blobs, being on pieces of paper taped to every wall. "Will you draw me into a blob?" said his father. "No," said his son, "that would be impossible." "Why?" said his father, holding out his hands toward his son. because you lack blobness, said his son. What is that, said his father. And if I don't have it, is it something I can purchase at Walmart? By now his head was starting to shrink, his arms and legs thicken. No, you can't buy blobness, said his son. No one can. Then what is to become of me, cried his father. Go to your room, said his son, and I will bring you your supper, so your head can become smaller, your arms and legs get fat. If I do, if I go to my room, said his father, will you still love me? Of course, said his son, just not as much as blobs.
Thought-provoking and lots of fun. Is your new manuscript aligned with this kind of thinking?
Yes, so although I wouldn't say it's as phantasmagorical or absurdist. One reviewer recently in Buffalo said a number of these poems from the Men of the Casket, and I like this. I think that this is a sweet and very kind thing for him to say, that some of these poems plunge so headlong, this is the poems in Casket, plunge so headlong into the phantasmagoria that one thinks of William S. Burroughs reinterpreting Aesop's fables or Hunter S. Thompson rewriting Grimm's fairy tales. So the duende, the darker presences, are very prevalent, conspicuous and then subtextually in the Casket poems. Some of that is true as well in I have this manuscript at this point called Etcetera's Mistress, but I'm not quite sure I'm going to
I like that.
Use that title, but there's a number of poems that are involved in language and how language is as evasive to us even as we try to work with it, it escapes us. You know, the wonderful prose poet Russell Edson says that words are the enemies of poems. I don't necessarily agree with that, but there are times in which words can be the adversaries of poems, and sort of like trying to write through the words into that language, or that space between language where poems come up through the subconscious, or language comes up from a different place. I guess that's not a great interpretation of all that, but I'll just read this little untitled loose sonnet to get a sense of the loose sonnet. Again, some of the lines are end stop, but some end jam, and at the end there's almost a way in which the whole poem, I hope, sort of evaporates after the language has been laid out. So here's a little loose sonnet from this manuscript in progress. The language has always been smarter than us. It slinks, pounces on invisible mice, waits by the bowl just recently filled, looks up and stares through you, its tail curling into a question mark. Each moment, another chance to nap, for it to assume what it rests upon, or so you think. And who can think beyond the language? Who doesn't yearn to say cat without the cat itself? Go ahead, keep collecting those pieces of yarn, rubber squeak toys. Keep changing that litter box. No doubt your god is a stranger. How quickly it disappears when the stranger arrives.
Tom, what is enjambment, just for those who might be wondering?
Enjambment is when you take a line that doesn't end in its meaning. Or so I'll use the opposite example. An end stop line is where the meaning of the line finishes at the end of the line. Like, the language has always been smarter than us. Boom. You know, declarative sense there, noun, verb. And then as far as enjambment, I have in this poem, go ahead, keep collecting. Now the line bends around. Keep collecting what? Next line, those pieces of yarn, rubber squeak toys. End of that line. Okay, but we're not done with the line yet. We keep rolling it back. Keep changing that litter box. So that line threads through three actual lines to finish its sensibility, as it were.
So it's about where one line begins after the other line ends.
Yep.
Okay, and you do it really well. Tom Ward.
Well, many people before me have done better and then some. I'm just, as Hemingway says, standing on the shoulders of giants if I do it with some acumen.
What do you think of William Matthews' remark, the job of a poet is not to fall silent?
Oh, that's good. I like that a lot from Matthews. Of course, my favorite little Matthews quip is he says that poetry is mostly stand-up tragedy.
Oh, that's terrific, especially for you. I think that you qualify. Let's have another Tom Ward poem. This is the Library of Congress talking to Tom Ward, who's in New York.
Let's see. I feel like just reciting one from, this is the last poem from my book, Small Boat with Oars of Different Size. And we were talking about Eros and Thanatos, and this is a poem that's mostly just about Eros. I love hiking. I love the Adirondacks. We're so lucky around here to have these beautiful mountains a couple, 3 hours north of us, and that's also the Bristol Hills just south of us that buttress the Finger Lakes, those wonderful deep glacier lakes south of Rochester and Syracuse. And years back, after taking another hike up a mountain in the fall, and we have wonderful autumns up here with the colors and the smells. Stevens had that great line in A Postcard from a Volcano talking about autumn, where he says, "And we're grapes made sharp air sharper by their smell."
Mm.
And so this is one of the few poems. Most of my poems take weeks, months, sometimes years. I had one poem called Beats. It took me 15 years to get right, if in fact it is right. This poem, believe it or not, was one of those gifts. It arrived, and I probably only revised it maybe 10 times, and I just sort of knew it was done. And even though there are sub-sentences in it, it feels just sort of like one big brushstroke. And so I will read it from there, and as it were at the end of autumn here, if you go back just a little bit and think about high autumn and the trees and all their colors, this is where this poem has its atmosphere. It's called Walking Down This Mountain. Walking down this mountain. I'm coming home a little crazier than the maples, those maidens by the house gathering their butterscotch skirts, their arms generous with a first October frost. I'm dizzy as those trees that dip and spin in the light off the porch, like the girl just back from the Grange who danced, drank the thick sugary punch that made her tongue a red leaf, made it glow in his mouth, the boy down the street pulsing with more fire than he began.
Oh, pulsing. That's the word. That makes it all right, doesn't it?
Right. We would hope that we would pulse with a little more fire each day than we began. And so that's a little wish there.
Tom, we don't want to just make noise, do we, to fill the air as poets? So how do we know that as we speak, that we're not just adding litter to the world? I mean, I can validate that you are not. But generally speaking, there's an awful lot of it coming at you, isn't there?
Sure, but I'll go backtrack on that. I'm not so sure about adding litter. Well, as far as my general conversing in the world, you'll have to ask my wife about that one. As I'm known to over-communicate, and she can be an under-communicator. But as far as, when we get down to trying to write something, and I tend to write for the ear for the most part, although mm-hmm. that wasn't necessarily true with these prose poems in Casket, but with my other work and the new manuscript I'm working on, how do we know? I don't know. One way I know, I guess I can only speak for my media experience, is that as I work through a poem and wrestle with its twists and turns and try to come up with without forcing it, again, lead with the imagination and sidecarring my intelligence, whatever I may have, that there's a point in which you realize that this poem you're working on is a bastard child of another one, isn't really offering a new clairvoyance or a new perception about the world and the big things and the small things, and that basically it's time to discard that poem or get rid of it. You can always cannibalize a line or two from a discarded or what we call failed poem and get it to be used in something else. And I have a journal which is full of some lines from many, many failed poems that I go back to at times and I'm able sometimes to steal and take a line and twist it or usurp it and make it function in a way that's heart intelligent to the reader. And so that, it works in the poem. And I'm fond of what Stephen Dobbins has said in his wonderful collection. collection of essays, Best Words, Best Order. Really, I can think of no better sort of universal metaphor when he says that what we're looking to do is to move our readers, of course, all movies that we love, music that we love, paintings that we love, does do the same thing. But in our poems and stories, we're looking to move our readers from indifference to curiosity to interest to anticipation.
Mm.
And if you can get the language to move seemingly effortlessly to a place where the reader is in this anticipation mode, then you've really captured their body and their mind and their emotions, and they're going to run with a poem and they're going to get something out of it. But if you can't do that in the writing and draftings of a particular poem, and you know that by sharing poems with people who you trust as good, solid, objective readers, and I do that with a number of people, then it's time to say bye-bye to that little poem and go elsewhere.
Tom Ward has tied up a lot of little poems into a book recently called The Matter of the Casket at Custom Words, which came out in 2007, and you can find that information online to order that book. It is funny, sweet, it's hilarious, it's bittersweet. Tom, how is it that you have found a way not to frighten yourself as you go darker and darker to get lighter and lighter? And you do that, you know.
I'm not sure. Maybe it's because I'm a quintessential Gemini. I'm one of those weirdos. I know it drives people crazy. My dear office mates, Nora Jones and Peter Connors, I talk to myself frequently. I don't believe at this point I would call that I have a split personality, but there are many voices and many sensibilities that are competing for attention, language attention, both orally and then in the written form. And obviously some of that stuff is, you know, we would call darker, more macabre, and others, because I still I love laughter and I love telling jokes, being an old Irish guy that I am, that sense of my brain or psyche is important, and I try to keep that nimble. I guess particularly in this manuscript, I will say that I've been writing prose poems for about 20 years, and most of them pretty badly. I started off writing them after, you know, read Charles Simic's wonderful collection, Pulitzer Prize collection, The World Doesn't End. And I went back to Francis Ponge and Mac Jacob and Tate and Russell, Tate and Russell Edson, and other fine prose poems writers. And a lot of that stuff was imitative, but this collection was actually spawned world affairs. I'm not saying that I do a whole lot to affect world affairs in a benevolent way. I'm just more of a watcher, as many writers are. And, you know, I don't want to go so far as to say that I'm von Goethean about it. I don't know how I'd say for Vonnegut, but, you know, I mean, if Vonnegut doesn't experience literally Dresden, the horrible bombing, you know, we don't get Slaughterhouse-Five. We know that for sure. So I think any poet or writer who's worth any kind of merit or attention to look at and to read and to contemplate their work, there should be some kind of covert or overt relationship to the greater happenings of the world at large. Mine tend to be covert. I'm not very good at all at writing what we call directly a political poem. I just can't do that. I have to. That's when my head gets in the way of my imagination, and it doesn't work. But there's a poem in here that I call, well, there's a poem here I have it called Intelligent Design, and we know about what the scuttlebutt with all that in the last few years and the silliness of that, and these Bible beaters trying to debunk evolution. And I have another poem in here that I called Guardians, and if I have one thing I wish I kicked myself about, I wish I had changed that poem, Guardian, and called it Family Values, because really that's what it was looking at. I just sort of missed on the title, and it would have been a little bit more of an overt connection to that much maligned and misunderstood and ballyhooed word or phrase, family values.
Let's pick us up a poem.
Well, fact, why don't I just read that one I was talking about that's called Guardian, but I like to retitle it in my own imagination, Family Values. Family Values. Fortified by plastic fangs, plastic horns, cardboard wings, one summer morning a man climbs up on his roof and crouches. He has always admired gargoyles, their claws and fiendish eyes, how they squat on the precipices of Gothic churches, the fact they never have to speak. Now, he is in a good gargoyle crouch, looking across his front yard toward his neighbors cutting and bagging grass. He wonders if his eyes look spooky enough. That will be something to work on, he thinks. The man remains stone still, crouched on the corner of his roof, plastic fangs, plastic horns, cardboard wings. When are you coming down? His wife asks, focusing on a small gray thing against the night sky. Never, says the man, without turning his head. They'll have to demolish this church. It's not a church. It's a house, says his wife. A house with your wife and children. Gargoyles don't have wives or children, says the man. They're too busy guarding what must be guarded. Bingo, his wife shouts. And what must be guarded is your wife and your children, but from down here on the ground where people live. Gargoyles don't have wives or children, says the man. They're too busy guarding what must be guarded.
Tom is talking to us. Is T-H-O-M an Irish spelling, Tom?
Well, no, not necessarily. I just thought this, and I love my family dearly, but the uncreativity they used in naming, we say, generations of males. I'm the seventh straight Thomas Ward, you know, T-H-O-M-A-S, my Christian name, and I thought, you know, at some point, I thought, and everybody's Tom, nicknamed T-O-M, I thought, I'd like to make it different. Well, maybe it's a bit vain, whatever, but I figure, why should I lose my H just because I shortened my name from Thomas to Tom? So that's how that stays. It also distinguishes myself from my father and my grandfather and back and back and back and back and whatever.
We wouldn't want
too many Toms.
We wouldn't want you to lose your H for anything in this world, Tom. And we want another poem, though, whether it be the new manuscript or the matter of the casket, which is his really, I think, stunning, crisp, startling group of prose poems that came out in 2007 from Custom Words. I'm Grace Cavalieri at the Library of Congress, and the library is talking to Tom, even though he shoveled out so many driveways last night. Tom, take a deep breath and give us a good poem.
Sure. This is from the new manuscript. It's called Goldfinch Cockroach, and a number of the titles, I try to put things in apposition. Carl Sandburg said that some of our best poems are the synthesis of hyacinths and biscuits, disparate things, although hyacinths and biscuits have that wonderful sound alliteration in them, and that if you put these two things together, maybe one beautiful, maybe one ugly, and then you run it through your imagination, what might come out as a third body, a third thing. So this is another one of those loose sonnets which runs its lines down through, and it's simply called Goldfinch Cockroach. Once in a while, my soul exits this body, goes shopping for another house of flesh. Giant sheets of ice, north and south of us, rip from their moorings, crash into the sea. Those with the most superfluous gadgets cast the longest shadows, but not enough to thwart ultraviolet rays. For a dollar, the drunk outside the corner bar will share fantastic stories from the captain of the ship in the bottle. Yes, that's correct. Goldfinches no longer visit our garden, and the cockroaches have a new king. My soul is a fickle shopper, rummaging through clearance sale bins. What you didn't do, what I did. At the end, all we can hope for are the right regrets.
Tom Ward is in his office at Boa Publishing, and it is a publishing house that has made its mark doing not only very individual and original poets, but poetry and translation as well as fiction. Tom, just quickly summarize what your publishing house does in the world. Just a couple of the people that you've published. You must do about 10 a year.
Yeah, we publish at this point 10 to 11 books a year. Contemporary American poetry, of course, and poetry in translation, which we're very fond of. That is an important thing. Our founder, the late poet, edit, critic, and anthologist, and wonderful translator, Al Pullen, A. Pullen Jr., developed or made Boa a reality 31 years ago, as he used to love to say, with all the confidence of an experience, he would bark out. And, you know, he grew the press in important ways and brought poets such as W.D. Snodgrass and Lucille Clifton. And he also started the press because he saw that a lot of young, important, talented poets could not find publication in the larger commercial houses. So we've published, this year we've published our 30th new poet, first book.
Wow.
By a poet. We're very proud of that. And that evolved into a contest about 6 years ago, and we aptly named it the A. Pullen Jr. Poetry Prize to honor Al and his wonderful champion work of young poets. So at this point, you know, as far as important poets, I think all of our poets are important. We've published over 200 collections and reprinted, I don't know, at least 1,000 times a number of books. But the poets of note that many people would recognize, again, would be Lucille Clifton, Lee Young Lee, W.D. Snodgrass, Carolyn Kaiser, Naomi Shihab Nye, Lewis Simpson, Russell Edson, Bridget Pegan Kelly, Dorian Lux, Kimet Anisio, and others. We did a translation of his work, Flowers of a Moment, which are very sort of zen-like haiku. They're not haiku, but they're brief, penetrating, deep, powerful, but also playful little poems. And again, it has his original calligraphy, and when that came out last fall, he went to the Dodge Poetry Festival and was a huge hit as he read there with his translator. And we're very happy to offer these translations. Again, we have collections of translations from, oh my gosh, over 24 languages: Chinese, Portuguese, Spanish, French, Greek, Korean, Albanian. We just did Israeli, Iraq. We have an Iraqi collection from Fadil al-Azawi called Miracle Maker, and I'm most proud of that because in publishing that book, I suppose we violated the Patriots Act, or the Unpatriots Act, as I like to call it, because we brought a man who was an Iraqi. Obviously, he's not a militant. He's just a human being who happened to be born in Iraq and actually was tortured by the Ba'athist Party in Saddam Hussein, and brings a beautiful perspective of language and what it's like to have been in Iraq for the last couple decades. And it's a very, very important collection called Miracle Maker.
Tom, we did not hear the name of the Korean poet, so just say it very slowly.
Oh, I'm sorry. His name is Goo Oon. It's actually spelled K-O-U-N.
Two different words.
Yeah.
Okay.
Goo Oon, and the collection is Flowers of a Moment, and it's translated by Gary Gok, Brother Anthony, and a gentleman named Young Moon Kim.
Tom, may we have a closing poem of your own, please?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. Let's do the closing book in the matter of the casket. We go from Eros, we'll go all the way down to the line to pure Thanatos, and I really appreciate the time here, Grace, with you. Wonderful questions, and I appreciate the listeners for listening.
We're better. We're better for it, Tom.
Out of the casket, and simply called Statement. He said he wanted to be the only one at his interment. Of course, he didn't count on the sky showing up a clump of gray or one pop of thunder like the burst of a pistol. A few days he stretched their necks to get a glimpse of the sun, which, respecting his statement, refused to glare. Beneath the pile of dirt, the grass tried to move its green fingers. Three crows watched from the branches of an oak. Gravestones waited. A congregation of nothings, everything. Or was it he said he wanted to be the only thing at his funeral? Admirable, perhaps, but there is always the matter of the casket.
That is the voice of Tom Ward. The book is The Matter of the Casket. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media, with post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Associate producer is Ken Flynn. We wish to thank the Witter Binner Foundation for funding the series and the Library of Congress for its assistance and support. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.